All righty. Amen. Well, hello again. Good to EC everybody once again. I am honored to be able to present to you the word. As the pastor mentioned, this is This is Global Youth Day, and this is also a continuation of this week is a continuation of Women's History Month. And I have to tell you that the sermon today ain't got nothing to do with either one of those. I got a word that's given to me, and that's what I'm going to give to you. And I hope that despite that, it is something that you will find value in. The title of the message is 20th Century Vice. So I will speak to you about some things today, that some of which you will agree with, some of which you might not agree with, but I hope whether you agree or whether you do not agree, you will take the time to think about the point of view that I'm going to present and come up with your own biblical response to it. And that's all I can ask. And we'll be good to go if we all do that. 20th century vice. Now, we know that the Bible says that there's nothing new under the sun. So everything that's going on has been going on. But of course, there are some things that are particular to this day and age that may not have been portrayed or emphasized as much in the Bible, mainly because of technology and that type of thing. So, but there are some other things that deal with attitude as well that I think are particular to this age. And I'm going to be talking about that. But before I do that, I do want to mention a little bit about Time Magazine Person of the Year, which I'm sure you all have heard of. Time Magazine Person of the Year. The first one given was 1927. Care to guess who that was? I'll give you a little bit of a hint without looking it up. Can you guess? It was in the transportation industry, 1927. If you have a guess, just type that in the chat. I'll take a look. So I'll give you a couple of minutes while I give you some other little factoids about the Time Magazine Person of the Year. Henry Ford, pretty good guess. That's not correct though. I will say that Walter Chrysler, I believe, was actually the second awardee to receive it. So that's pretty close. But no, it wasn't Henry Ford. All right, so keep those guesses coming. The Wright brothers, nope, a little bit, that's a little bit, they were a little bit earlier. But anyway, so the most recent winners were Joe and Kamala. So Ginger and I earlier this year were trying to figure out who it might be before the award was actually given or announced. We had narrowed it down to Anthony Fauci, Joe Biden, and the first line health workers. Those were our three guesses. I think my square was on, my money was on Anthony Fauci, and I think Ginger's, I'm not sure, but I think hers were on the first line health responders. And ended up being the one that neither one of us chose, Joe Biden. But we did have it in our top three. So in fact, all American presidents, with the exception of three, have won the award at least once. The three that did not, Calvin Coolidge, he was the sitting president when the first one, announced. So maybe he gets a bit of a pass. Herbert Hoover didn't receive it, and Gerald Ford didn't receive it. Every other president, yes, including our last president, received the award at least once. The first woman to receive the award, you all are coming up with some pretty good guesses. Nobody's correct, though. Amelia Earhart's pretty close. I will give you that further hint. Amelia Earhart is very close. There you go. Somebody got it. Charles Lindbergh. Charles Lindbergh was the first one to receive the Time Magazine Person of the Year. The first woman to receive it was a woman named Wallace Warfield Simpson. So maybe this is my little bit of a tie-in to Women's History Month. I'll get it in some kind of way. Wallace Warfield Simpson. I never heard of this woman. W-A-L-L-I-S. But she must have been a remarkable woman. First of all, she won the Time Magazine Woman of the Year. But it also, in what I was reading, said King Edward VIII abdicated the English throne so that he could marry her. So she must have been really something. I don't know what she did, but somebody already just typed that into the chat there. So somebody knows a little bit of history. Anyway, so it was switched from Man of the Year to the more gender neutral Person of the Year in 1999. That year, Jeff Bezos won it, the founder of Amazon and the current world's most richest man. Did you know that you won the Time Magazine Person of the Year? That was in 2006. You won Time Magazine Person of the Year. I don't know what the sentiment was behind that, but that's who won it. You did. The person who's won it, there's been several people who've won it twice. Only one who's won it three times. And that is FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So there's a list. Oh, incidentally, Kamala is the first Black woman to receive the award. You could probably guess who the first Black man was. Martin Luther King, 1963. There have been several. I mean, if you go through the list back to 1927, it's a who's who of world history. Very prominent names, some names that you've never heard. An inanimate object won it, the computer, in one year. But it's, you know, some of the names are typical. It says that the award is not an honor per se, meaning that the person who won it isn't always someone you would look up to. So in that vein, you will find people like Ayatollah Khomeini on there. You'll find Joseph Stalin on there. And yes, you'll even find that guy. Adolf Hitler won it in 1938 or 39. Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler won it back-to-back years, 1938 and 39. I'm not sure which is which. Of course, that was before World War II. But they did have, Time Magazine did have the sense of when they put Hitler's picture on there, apparently there were some dead bodies hanging in the, on the picture, on the cover of the magazine. So apparently they had some idea as to who he would be. But there you go. That's a little bit of history about the Time Magazine Person of the Year. I mentioned that because for me, this kind of marks the beginning of the modern era of the me era, the glorification of ourselves. We live in a celebrity-worshiping, fame-seeking, self-congratulatory, and self-indulgent society. Everybody wants to be that one. Everybody wants to be that one. That's why I hate watching these, most of these reality shows, because you get a bunch of people in a big room and, you know, you put a camera on them and everybody just acts out trying to make a name for themselves and become the next famous person. Most of us will never come close to being that one, but no matter how obscure our real lives are, we never quite lose that itch to live like they do on the other side of society, the side where only the chosen are invited to go. I say that, and you can tell that we never lose that itch by the way we treat ourselves. Pamper parties, month-long birthday celebrations, self-rewarding shopping sprees, luxurious self-care vacations. These are just a few of the spoils of life that we afford ourselves. We spare no expense. We spare no expense when it comes to loving on ourselves and giving ourselves a taste, no matter how faint, of that celebrity lifestyle. Now, while pride, as well as all other human shortcomings, go back as far as recorded history, I would say that, in my estimation, the frequency, the intensity, and the sheer brazenness of our willingness to absolutely shower ourselves with the niceties of fine living is at an all-time high. We dote on ourselves. We dote on ourselves like a brand new father over his newborn baby girl. Our society tells us that in order to love others, we must first love ourselves. That's what our society tells us. Our society says that in order to effectively take care of others, we must first take care of ourselves. Physician, heal thyself, they say. And like a flight attendant on an overseas flight, telling people that in the case of emergency, put your mask on first before you help others. That's how society thinks, and that's what they tell us. And while all of that sounds really good, sounds quite reasonable, in fact, who doesn't want all of their needs taken care of first? I have to tell you, that ain't biblical. Sounds great, and it's the present theory of today, but it's not biblical. In fact, Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 through 39, the Bible tells us that the greatest, and not only the greatest, but the first commandment is to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and mind. Then after that, love your neighbor as yourself. The implication there is you're already going to love yourself. You're born with that. It's as natural to most people as breathing. Yeah, there are some situations, there are some circumstances where people have lived lives that are so beaten down that they don't love themselves. Yeah, but most of y'all, most of us, we don't have any problems loving ourselves. History has taught us that it's a natural thing. In fact, this skill has been sharpened to a razor tooth point for most people. It's those other two things that we fall flat. The love for God and love our neighbors as ourselves. So society has this chart upside down. They got this train running backwards. And the unfortunate part about this is that this thinking has made its way solidly into religious culture. Many of today's pastors, especially the well-known mega pastors, and this is a soapbox that I get on frequently, because I think most of these pastors, the mega pastors, are just criminal. I think they're criminal, the worst part of society. That's what I think. Most of these pastors today are just well-dressed motivational speakers. Well-dressed and well-paid, I might add. Motivational speakers. The poster child for this is your boy Joel Osteen. But there are many people whose names I could call, But he's the poster boy for this. You know, you listen to Joel Osteen, you come out of his sermon feeling on top of the world about yourself. Matter of fact, Ginger listened to something that he said a while back, and that's what she said. Well, yeah, she said, yeah, you come out of, when you definitely be feeling good about yourself. Feeling good about yourself is great. It's wonderful. And every now and then you do need a sermon like that to encourage your soul and get you feeling good about yourself. Yeah, but every now and then you also need to be challenged. Somebody like Joel Osteen is not going to challenge you. He wants you to feel good about yourself all the time, and I want you to feel good about yourself all the time, but you got to be challenged at some point. Feeling good about yourself is great as long as it doesn't cause you to ignore and overlook some problems. So a while ago, some of you may remember, but maybe you don't, you probably don't. A few years ago, I tore my rotator cuff. My left shoulder. Matter of fact, I still have, and I will always have for the rest of my life, three pins in my shoulder, holding my rotator cuff together, So I had the surgery, and after this, it was just a quick in and out surgery, if there's such a thing. I went home, they sent me home, and they gave me some Percocet. Powerful painkiller. So they said, start taking this tomorrow. So the next day I woke up, I wasn't feeling too bad. My shoulder was, you know, I was expecting to be in agony. My shoulder actually wasn't feeling that bad. I was like, no, I'm not taking this Percocet. I feel all right. I feel pretty good. You know, I'm thinking I'm all tough. You know, I'm talking to Cerise. Cerise called me, I guess, or I called her because, you know, whenever anybody with any medical problem, you know, in my age group at least, we always talk to Cerise. she's our medical resource. Anyway, I was talking to Cerise like the next day, you know, and I'm feeling all, you know, like tough guy bragging, you know, oh, this my shoulder didn't hurt at all. I could deal with this. I don't need this. She was like, yeah, about that. The anesthesia hasn't quite worn off yet. So I was like, oh, this girl, I don't know what she's talking about. I'm still not taking this Percocet. But so I didn't take the Percocet. The next day, 2 days after the surgery, oh, I woke up. I was in agony. I couldn't get to that Percocet fast enough. So for a minute there, my shoulder was feeling good and I was feeling good about myself, but it was covering up something that was coming that was going to be real significant. So feeling good about yourself is great. We talked about feelings this morning in Sabbath school, as a matter of fact. Feelings can fool you. And you cannot rely on your feelings, not in a spiritual sense. Because didn't Joshua and his army, didn't they feel great about themselves when they went to fight Ai, or whatever that city was, where they ended up getting beat pretty bad there? They felt great about themselves going in, but that feeling great was covering up something that had to be revealed. What good is it? And I think we have something going on here. Sister Langley, let me just interrupt here. Sister Langley, I think you are pushing some buttons here and you're screen sharing. So if you can take care of that and get that off. But I assume everybody can still hear me.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, I'm trying to.
Yep, I can hear you.
Yeah, I know. I'm still trying to give her just a second here to get that taken care of. But I will just move on if somebody can. Okay, there we go. So what good is it to come out of church feeling good about yourself while simultaneously leaving all of your spiritual questions and problems unaddressed? But I can understand the philosophy, loving on yourself and build up yourself. I understand that. I understand why it's so powerful, especially in the African-American community, which many of us are a part, where we grew up in the country. Maybe I didn't grow up in the country. At least I didn't think I did until the last few years. I didn't, you know, we grew up in a country that took purposeful, malicious, and systematic steps to degrade, dehumanize, and destroy our minds in the African-American community and our senses of ourselves. I can understand why us in this community would readily want to grab onto this philosophy of loving ourselves first and building up ourselves first. All this stuff took place just one generation ago. We're not talking about, you know, 1,000 years ago. We're not talking about Bible times. We're talking about people who I know and love, like my parents and many of you all going through some of this stuff. So I understand it, but it's still not biblical. For sure, all of that stuff needs to be dealt with. Those systematic, purposeful, malicious things that were done to degrade and dehumanize us, all that has to be dealt with. And it has to be dealt with just as purposefully and just as systematically as it was perpetrated against us. But I will say, you deal with it by teaching our true history and contributions of our ancestors and of our current community, teaching the true history and contributions. I say you deal with it by making your community where you live one that supports each other in your positive endeavors and attitudes. And while simultaneously, and this is very important, consistently holding each other accountable when those endeavors and attitudes are destructive. I say you deal with it by exemplifying and encouraging godly, constructive principles while making sure not to glamorize foolishness. There are many positive long-term ways to overcome the stony road we've trod, but you don't overcome evil foolishness coming at you from one direction by going equally foolishly in the opposite direction. First, because that doesn't make sense. Second, because it's not biblical. It's like these parents, you know, who grew up poor. Parents who grew up poor, and they are so determined that their own children, that they're not going to expose their own children to all the things that they were exposed to and experienced growing up because they were poor. So now that they got a little bit of money and they've done well for themselves, these parents, in order to counteract the possibility of their children experiencing those things, they go overboard by indulging their children's every whim, and they end up raising children who are completely out of touch with reality and incapable of managing adversity in any form, or negotiating any type of obstacles successfully. You put one little trip up in their way and then, you know, they give up and go running to mommy. So you may think that this self-pampering, self-congratulatory lifestyle is a legitimate response to the wrongs that have been done you. You may feel that the world owes you one. And if they're not going to give it to you, then you'll just give it to yourself. But it's just not biblical. It's all based on pride. And as 1 John chapter 2, verse 16 says, it's a prescription from the world. So as Christians, we rightfully look to the Bible to instruct us on how to live. In this case, I think the Bible is just as instructive by what it doesn't say as it is by what it does say. I can't think of any time, and you know, I'm reluctant to say I can't think, you know, never, because you know, I like think I know the Bible, but I don't know it completely like that. So there may be something, but I can't think of any time where the Bible stresses the importance of putting yourself first. I can't think of any time where the Bible talks about somebody who went out of his way to pamper and luxuriate himself, and it was seen as something positive. The Bible doesn't seem to even contemplate this philosophy where we have to constantly heap praise on ourselves in order to maintain our mental balance. Yeah, James chapter 3, verse 4, chapter 4, verse 3, I'm sorry, encourage us to ask God for what we want, you know, kind of, yeah, you want something, ask God for it. But then it warns us that if you're just asking just to spend it on yourself, you're not going to get what you're asking for. That's what it says. In fact, the Bible seems to put much more energy into keeping us humble and not boasting. The Bible seems to warn us quite a bit to avoid pride and self-dealing. A strategy that it recommends, according to my reading, is to put others' interests, other people's interests, even before your own. Sure, Jesus called his disciples apart to rest for a while. And some might take that as their inspiration to go off and focus on themselves for a while. But if you look deeper into that, Jesus called his disciples apart after they had poured out their bodies for the gospel to the point where, and this is what the Bible says, they literally didn't have time to eat. But can you imagine Jesus saying any of the following things to the brothers, to the disciples? See if you can imagine Jesus saying this. Come on, guys, let's go into town and blow off some steam. Or maybe, yeah, we work hard, but we play even harder. You think Jesus would say anything like that, or even, you know, or even something as innocent as, let's spend a few days focusing on ourselves? Can you imagine Jesus saying any of those things? But we would rather, in the name of mental health, focus on ourselves, love on ourselves, and pamper ourselves. You may call it many different things. Some of these sound very innocent and some even sound very beneficial. But no matter how you dress it up, at its heart, it boils down to self-centeredness. It seems to me that if you read the Bible from the viewpoint of mental health, it's as if the Bible suggests a different strategy, a different way of thinking. Seems like the Bible suggests that we take care of our mental health by taking care of others. So one of my childhood memories, and this is, I don't know if my mother remembers this, but I remember it. And this is such a routine childhood activity that my mother probably doesn't remember it. She took me to the pediatrician one time. And I'd imagine that, you know, I went to the pediatrician several times, but I only remember one trip to the pediatrician when I was, I don't even know how I was a child, seven, eight, somewhere in there. The pediatrician I went to was an Asian guy. And I mentioned that for a reason that will become evident in just a moment. So I went there in this age of vaccinations that we're talking about now. I went there to receive a shot of some kind. I guess it was, you know, one of the childhood vaccinations that you get or something. I was getting a needle. That's all I know. And of course, nobody likes needles. especially not a 7-year-old child. So, you know, you get worried and, you know, you think the worst and, you know, don't want to go and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's one of those things that we all had to go through. So my mother took me to the pediatrician, this Asian guy. So when we were in the exam room, my mother was standing right there. The doctor was right there. It's just the three of us. So he asked me a question. And I think it was, I don't remember the question, but it was some trivial question, like what grade are you in or what school do you go to or something like that. But his accent was so thick that I couldn't understand what he was saying. And I was like, what? And so he asked me again. And I still couldn't add, I'm like, Mom, is he speaking English? I mean, I couldn't understand him. But, and then he added, it wasn't until the third time I had to say, what, three times that I heard his question, and then I answered. And after I answered his question, I realized he gave me the needle. And this is probably a technique that all pediatricians use, or many pediatricians use. But after I understood the question and I answered this question, he was done. He started packing up or whatever. I'm like, what happened? I didn't feel a thing. I didn't feel a thing. I was so concentrating on him, on the doctor, and what he was trying to say, that he stuck me with the needle and I didn't even know it. That's how it is. And now I know, I don't know, I never really understood why this memory would come back to me every now and then. And I never understood why this childhood memory just stuck with me for some reason. And now that I'm older, I understand that God gave me a message when I was 7 years old to pass on to you today, March 20th, 2021, now that I'm 51 years old. He gave me this message to pass to you today when I was seven, that you got to think a different way about your mental health. You got to stop focusing on yourself and start focusing on each other. You got to try a new strategy. We feel like we've got so many problems because we're always thinking about our problems. Everything stresses us out because we always think about how stressed out we are. We're so worried about going crazy that we're driving ourselves crazy. It is self-fulfilling prophecy. And I know that mental health is one of those trendy topics of the day. It reminds me though of this diabetes doctor that came to Pisgah a couple of years ago. I have no memory of his name. Even if you said it, I probably wouldn't remember. But I think his expertise was diabetes, or he was talking about diabetes. I do know that. And one thing he said was, you know, yes, there is a subset of people with diabetes who need to take medicine for it. But most people who are pre-diabetic or with diabetes don't need to take medicine. Most people need to change their lifestyles. It's the same way with mental health. People want to use medicine to control their diabetes, when it's really only a small subset of people who need that medicine. Yes, there are some people with some serious, deep-seated, long-term psychological issues that need to be dealt with the most intensive professional care and maybe even medicine. But most people, I think, just need an attitude adjustment when it comes to their mental health. I've never been on this medicine as a mental health strategy bandwagon. Going back, you know, 30 years or so, when I first started hearing about you know, the mainstream diagnosis of children with, you know, ADD and ADHD and CNN and MSNBC and whatever else they diagnosing people with. When I first started hearing about all of that, I've always had this feeling that these trendy psychological diagnoses were somewhat overused. And now we've got this entire anti-anxiety industry, mostly based on prescription drugs. Meanwhile, depression rates keep going up, suicides keep going up. The more we talk about mental health, the more people kill themselves. It's because we're talking about mental health from a self-focused point of view. We got to try a new strategy. Most people don't need medicine to control their mental health. There just needs to be an attitude adjustment. I have, despite what I'm saying, and so I don't know how you all are taking it, but I'm sure we'll hear about it at the end when we have an opportunity to speak, when everybody has an opportunity to speak. But despite what I'm saying, I have no interest in my church as a whole or any individual in the church burying their heads in the sand when it comes to mental health. I would, however, like to suggest a different approach. Why don't you try tending to your mental health by focusing on alleviating other people's suffering? How about a strategy, this strategy, instead of going around telling everybody what your love language is, as if we need you to tell us how to love you better and how to please you better, instead of telling everybody what your love language is, why don't you go and let your love language be do unto others as you would have them to do unto you. Let that be your love language. Maybe you should look to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 7, where it talks about believers, fellow believers, taking each other to court to right the wrongs that have been done against each other. Why don't we take the suggestion that Paul gave to that church in Corinth? Instead of trying to avenge every wrong that's done against us, every now and then, maybe it's just better to let some stuff slide. Maybe that'll help your mental health. Maybe your mental health will be better served if you didn't anoint yourself person of the year every single year and treat yourself like an A-list celebrity. How about following the counsel found in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4? By esteeming others better than yourself, and not only looking after your own interests, but also looking after the interests of others. These are just some of the strategies that the Bible suggests to help deal with your mental and, oh, by the way, spiritual health. But I'd like to leave just one final suggestion to deal with your mental health. Instead of being so concerned with loving on yourself, why don't you try allowing others to love you a little bit? You know, not everybody who expresses some concern for you is trying to be up in your business. I will announce to you today, not everybody who contacts you has an ulterior motive, but we got to look underneath and around and behind every action that people try to do for us. Some people are actually trying to live out the suggestion in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, by esteeming others better than themselves and looking out for the interests of others as well as their own. But we're so worried about other people tearing us down that we think that everybody's trying to tear us down. And I will say this, if that is your history, that everybody you've come across has tried to tear you down, then you need some new friends But rather than get new friends, we'd rather keep going back to those same no good, tired friends, that same no good, tired family who ain't doing no good for you, who's selfish as they come. We'd rather keep going back to those same people and write everybody off, write everybody else off because of these same tired people we keep going back to based off of them, and use that as an excuse to give yourself every award that you can think of. You don't have to stand in the mirror and tell yourself how great you are. Truly, I say unto you, unless you be converted and become as little children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant. Do that, and you might actually feel a little better about yourself.